get this one going also. Okay, I think they're both going now. Today's date is May the 1st, 2012. My name is Jonathan Gerland. I'm with Jack Sweeney. We're at the History Center, continuing our oral history interview that we started last week. And we were just talking before we turned the recorders on, trying to remember exactly where we left off. So I'll just leave that to you, Jack. You just want to start off with, I think we looked at when you came back from Dallas to Dieball. Right. What was going on then with the company and you know, from your perspective as well?
Well, in terms of my perspective, you know, I'd been a road salesman in Tyler, and then we consolidated territory and moved to Dallas in 1976. And in the early part of 78, I got the opportunity to move back into management in Dieball as a product manager for the particle board group, which by that time had, you know, the Dieball particle board plant was up and running, the bigger plant. We had built a plant in Thompson, Georgia. So we had kind of a national presence on particle board. We were on the verge of acquiring a plant in Monroeville, Alabama. That happened right after I came back. So the particle board group had become, you know, a very integral part and a fairly large part of the organization. So I came back in to do that, working for Harold Maxwell, who was vice president of marketing at the time. And you know, those were fairly difficult years in the economy. We were coming off some great years in 78, 79, but by the early 80s, we hit the, you know, hyperinflation, the double-dip recession in 81, spilling into 82. So were pretty difficult times in the building products group because the housing markets were down. And, you know, I know we don't want to get into personalities too much here, but it was a very difficult time for another reason. The company had brought a guy from Austin named Wayne McDonald in to be the executive vice president. And now remember, we were operating as Temple East Tex, and that was the paper mill and the building products group inside of Time Inc. And Wayne had been in the financial group in Austin. He'd been with LIC.
That'd be Lumberman's Investment
Lumberman's
Corporation.
Investment Corp, okay. Which was a mortgage banking real estate investment company that had been started back in the 60s, actually. And was a very small part of the company, but, you know, Wayne was a very aggressive manager and really didn't understand the manufacturing side of the business. So he was very impatient, very dogmatic about things, and very difficult guy to deal with from a personal standpoint. Not so much to me, but to the guy running the paper mill and the people running building products at the time. The guy running building products was Henry Olubet. So
heard he had difficulty with some of the pilots as well.
He had difficulties with everybody. I went in a optometrist's office in Lufkin, and the lady asked me for my name and where I worked. And I said, I'm Jack Sweeney, Temple Inland. And you know, you knew everybody in Lufkin knew about Temple, right? But she made the comment. She said, oh, yeah, we're very familiar with a gentleman from Temple. And it was Wayne McDonald who had kind of thrown a fit in the optometrist's office. So Wayne was an equal opportunity offender of people. So very, very, very out of character with the culture, that the Temple culture. He was from a different world and didn't understand it, and was you know, I'll use this term later, but Wayne was always the smartest guy in the room, and people like that are pretty hard to deal with. And you know, even though a guy like Mr. Temple probably realistically was the smartest guy in the room, he didn't act like it all the time, and some people did. So it was a very difficult time business-wise. It was a difficult time for some of the people that worked here, and that led to a change in, right before the spinoff from Time, that led to a management change where Henry Holubek resigned from the company. Harold Maxwell stepped up to be over building products, and I moved from marketing into a job of vice president of operations. And Wayne, not too long after that, Wayne was taken out of this role and sent back to Austin, in a sense. With that, with the spinoff, which occurred
late 83,
the end of 83. I think, actually, we operated for our own account with Inside Time, Inc. Through that year. And then
Legally, it was January 1st of 84.
Right. So, 83, we operated as Inside of Time, but we kind of had our own account inside. And everything was taking place for the spinoff to occur at the end of 83. So these changes happened at the end of 82, and the markets started getting better, and that's one of the reasons I think the spinoff was timed or delayed. Originally, I think they planned on doing it in 82. Markets were getting better. Housing markets were getting better. Paper was getting some better. We were coming out of this recession from the high interest rates, or the double dip recession. And so it gave us a chance to come out in a better market condition, both operations. So now we're spun off. Clifford Grum is back in Dyball from New York. You know, he's the president, CEO. Mr. Temple's the chairman. And Temple Inland then is a standalone company again. I guess the circle has been completed now of having the company selling it and getting it back. And we were in a position where we didn't have a lot of debt, we didn't have a lot of burden that came out of Time Inc. So Temple Inland was really ready to go forward.
How were the three entities? Because this will come back later. I know Kenny Jastro made a big point about we're one company bringing the three groups together, only to break them up into three or more groups. But how did that this transition period, because you had Inland, you had building products, and then you had, as you mentioned, the financial side. Yeah. How was it in the beginning?
Well, in the beginning,
what's the relationship of everything?
In the beginning, there was kind of the financial group at that time was so small, it wasn't really on anybody's radar screen. It might make $5 million a year. You know, they might tie up $100 million and make $5 million. It was not even in the mainstream of the company until Wayne McDonald moved and became executive vice president, went on the board. You know, then he went back. The Lumberman's Investment Corporation was very small. There wasn't a savings and loan in there. And Inland and Temple Eastex operated totally separate. There was no transfer of people. They were almost like two companies. Their offices were in
Indianapolis,
and their culture was very strong. You know, Inland was started by a man named Henry Krannert, and they had their own culture. You know, they were kind of a family type atmosphere. They were run by Henry Goodrich, who was a guy very much like Mr. Temple. In fact, it was so separate, a little antidote here, that if Joe Denman, who was running Temple Inland, or Temple Eastex at the time, if he wanted to go to a paper mill that Inland had, he had to ask permission from a fellow named Jack Ames, who was running Inland at the time. So about the only time that those entities came together was at board meetings. Hmm. You know? I never remember a joint meeting where, you know, there was any crossover. It was very separate. So what it appeared to us was here that, you know, Temple Eastex was the primary entity. I mean, it was almost back to the days of Temple you know, before all this stuff happened, except now we had a paper mill and a million acres of timberland. And we had opportunities to grow and get bigger. But inland was a very separate, there was no crossover at all, none. And ultimately, that's what, you know, Jastrow was talking about, because, and this is for later in this story, but inland, when Ames left and a guy named Ed Babin left, their management didn't appear to be real strong, and they started struggling. And so later, they were struggling, but they had their own culture. And, you know, I remember a fellow named Dave Dobbin, Clifford sent him over to Indianapolis to get to the, you know, kind of get a start getting his arms around inland. And they kind of chewed him up and spit him out. I mean, he came back and there was not really any changes. They have very strong culture. It was allowed to exist that way, you know, to the point that inland's management changed and they weren't doing very well. Ames and Babin. Babin left inland to go run Georgia Pacific's liner board business, which was bigger than ours. He was a very good operator. And Ames was a very good operator. They were low cost, kind of low overhead, and they always made money.
And that's B-A-B-I-N?
B-A-B-I-N.
And A-M-E-S.
A little sidebar about Babin. This is jumping ahead later. And there was talk of, you know, the entities that by the late 90s, around the time Clifford was about to leave, about there needed to be more connection between the two. And Babin was from Mobile, Alabama. He was a Southern boy, and the offices were in Indianapolis, and he didn't like that part of the world very much. He wanted to come back to the South. And we were standing in Harold's office down here in the main office, and we owned about 20 or 30 acres right behind the office building. And Babin said, well, you know, we need to bring the company. We need to have one headquarters for the company instead of basically two. And Harold said, well, Ed, where do you think we ought to put it? If we had one, where would it be? And he was looking out the window, and he said, don't we own that land right out there? And Harold said, yeah. He said, right out there is where it should be. He wanted to come back to the South. And because nothing happened on that, and he got a chance to go to Atlanta, which was much closer to where, you know, he liked to be, and also run a bigger job than he had. He left, and after that, inland was, they started a slow decline into the quality of their operations and their cost, and they went to places where really there were periods where they didn't make money. And another sidebar, much later, the guy that took over inland was a guy named Ben Lankenshire, and he had been an HR guy, and he ran it for 3 or 4 or 5 years, 4 years, something like that. And then they went out and hired a guy named Bill Howells from who'd been at Union Camp to come in and run inland. And Lankenshire retired in Austin. He had sons that had a moving storage type business. And one day we were at a meeting in Austin, and he was there for some reason. He was in the building. And he got me off. I guess that was when I was running Forest. So it would have been after 96. He got me off to the side, and he said, Jack, he said, I hear Inland lost money last quarter. And I said, well, they did. Not a lot, but they did. He said, how can that be? We never lost money at Inland. Never. You know? So I think that's how far things have slipped at Inland. But we're getting way ahead of this thing. So, because part of what I want to make sure you get in this history is that when we came out of the spinoff with Time, for the next 17 years, building products grew faster, added more plants, became more integral to the overall company than it had been in the past. After Harold was named and, you know, the transition happened, we built a gypsum plant in Fletcher, Oklahoma. It was under Harold's leadership. That was the first plant we built. And I've always thought it interesting, kind of like Mr. Temple didn't build more sawmills. You know, when the company was emerging, he built a fiberboard plant, not another sawmill. We built a gypsum plant, not another sawmill. Okay? And that gypsum plant, along with the West Memphis gypsum plant we already had, that turned out to be an integral part of the most profitable, at our peak earnings in building products, the gypsum group was the most profitable group that we had. So we built a gypsum plant. We built the Buena sawmill in the 80s. We started it in about 84, 85. And I think it started up in 86. And then we built the Southwest Louisiana, DeQuincy, Louisiana sawmill. And we made the acquisition of Owens, Illinois, which was 360,000 acres of timberland. So now the timber base in East Texas and Southwest Louisiana grows from about a million one, to 1.5 million. Okay? And there was another small acquisition of about 90,000 acres. And so during this period, and Forest was being run by Glenn Chancellor at the time. So during this period, the forest base increases by 60%, you know, from 1 million to 1.6 million. And the sawmills were built to convert the forest, but to supply chips and bark to Evadale and to Orange, because we had two paper mills in East Texas. The O&I acquisition was not only timberland, but it was the Orange linerboard mill, which became Inland ran it, but we still had Evadale. So if you look at, you know, where we started in East Texas with 500,000 acres of timberland and Dieball and Pineland operations, you know, back in the 70s, now by the 90s, you know, by the early 90s, we have 1,600,000 acres of timberland controlling two paper mills in East Texas, and we've added two sawmills. We're in the process, you know, later we would get out of the plywood business in Pineland, build a new sawmill there, and we got in a joint venture on gypsum that actually gave us, you know, ended up being two more gypsum plants. We were in a joint venture on gypsum paper that ended up being a paper mill that Inland ran that we got control of much later. We built the Hope Arkansas particle board plant, which expanded that group. We ended up, this is all now between, you know, 83 and 2000. We started the joint venture, started building the MDF plant in El Dorado. We're on the verge of acquiring two more MDF plants, another particle board plant. It really was a period where our revenues went from in the $400 million range to at a peak of about $1.2 billion. We went from basically, you know, a sawmill in Dieball, a particle board plant in Dieball, fiberboard plant in Dieball, plywood plant and stud mill in Pineland, to 17 different manufacturing operations spread from, at one time, from New Hampshire to Texas to Pennsylvania.
What about Rome, Georgia?
Rome, Georgia was...
Is that a pretty big operation?
Yeah, how that came about was Inland Container had a joint venture with Mead Paper Company, and it was called Georgia Craft. And the entity of Georgia Craft had the Rome linerboard mill, a big virgin linerboard mill, They had built a sawmill there in the late 80s. And there was a plywood plant down in South Georgia around Macon. There was a paper mill in Macon, Georgia. And 1 million acres of timberland. So in the, you know, late 80s, well, 85, 86, the two companies were wanting to go different ways. Meade wanted to get into more specialty paper, heading in coated paperboard. Inland wanted to stay in linerboard. So they broke up Georgia Craft. And basically, if you look at the state of Georgia and just cut it in half from north to south, Meade took the Macon mill and 500,000 acres of timberland down south and the plywood plant and stuff, and Inland took 500,000 acres of timberland and the Rome paper mill and sawmill. And we were asked to get involved in the Rome sawmill in 1988. So that really in 1988 became a part of Building Products. And the paper mill was stayed a part of Inland. And the forest land came into the management, the forest management group headed up by Glenn Chancellor. And so now we've gone to 2.1 million acres of land that stretch Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, and East Texas. And so now by that time...
By this time, Mr. Temple is... pretty much out of the picture in a lot of the management stuff.
That's right. He is
purely, it's gone purely from an ownership class to a management class operation, pretty much. I know he was still very much influential.
Well, we'd have to look back. I don't remember exactly when Mr. Temple, I know Mr. Denman retired in 1988. He stayed after Mr. Temple, or retired from the board, I think, in 88. And, Mr. Temple was 75 when he stepped down as chairman.
Okay, it'd be about 95.
Yeah, right, about 95. It was after the acquisition of the savings and loan. When you look at the bigger picture, I've been talking about the manufacturing
right,
and stuff,
right.
But one of the more significant events, and that was led by Clifford, whose background was banking, in the savings and loan crisis of the late 80s, 88, 89, when that bubble burst, we were approached by a group, and I, for some reason, can't think of their name right now, who did deals, basically, and they convinced Clifford that there was an opportunity to buy some of these failed savings and loans and roll them into our financial services group. And in order to do that, certain things had to happen. First of all, to buy a savings loan, you had to be in the savings loan business. So I remember I wasn't directly involved in this, but there was a tremendous amount of work done on finding a savings loan that was basically sound. And they found one in Kilgore, Texas, and they bought it. And so now we had an S&L, and we were able then to pursue buying from the Resolution Trust Corporation some failed savings and loan.
What was the Kilgore operation?
It was a one branch, I think, savings and loan located in Kilgore, Texas.
Oh, okay. You don't remember the name?
No, I don't remember
okay,
the name.
Okay.
It probably Kilgore Savings and Loan, but
okay.
I don't remember the name. Because, like I say, we weren't directly involved in that. But
it was just to get you in the door.
That's right. You had to have a footprint
right.
to be able to do the other. So, you know, we were able to do that. And then we bought, you know, three failed savings and loan, primarily on a corridor from Dallas to San Antonio, okay, up and down that corridor. And obviously there were some in Houston, but the main thrust was – along there. That's where those...
I-35.
Right.
Yeah.
And they took the name Guarantee. That was one of the ones that had failed. They took that name and started building the savings and loan. And basically, you know, later I understood that we were the only industrial company in the United States that owned a savings and loan because there were restrictions about things like that. But because of the need to sell them and us having a financial services group and us having a savings and loan, we were able to buy this entity, put this entity together. And as it turned out, not only, you know, I mentioned earlier some of the earnings problems that Inland had, and the savings loan ended up being not only a good source of funds, but it ended up being the best takeover protection that we ever had in Temple Inland. Because IP would have had to divest the savings and loan if they had bought us at that time. They didn't, you know, most companies didn't know what to do with it. They didn't know if they could get government approval to do it. So in a sense, one of the benefits of owning the savings and loan was that it offered some protection against being taken over by a strategic buyer, like what ended up happening, you know, here recently. But it also did some things. Now, you know, Mr. Temple was against doing the savings and loan. He spoke against it in board meetings. He said, what do you have if you got it and you turn it around? You just got a big old bank. You know, it turned out, I think, to kind of be a diversion. It was Mr. Temple used this term once about an entity in Lufkin. He said, you know, it's an elegant thing to have, right? And so the bank was an elegant thing to have in the company. And it did create earnings, and it gave us a different story. But it diverted, I think, and started the move to change the culture in the company away from a manufacturing company to a financial company. It led to some selections of, you know, who took Clifford's place. And that led to, I think, the end of the company as a manufacturing company. So, you know, I guess the bank is like most things. It was good and bad in some ways, in many ways, I guess. I think if you looked at it just from a business perspective, it was a plus. And there were times when it was extremely important, you know, to the company, to Temple Inland. But it, underneath the covers, it became, I think, a distraction, and it became something that was, we had an odd mix of assets. I think the bank is what attracted Carl Icahn in 2005 to the company. I think he thought there was a lot of value in that savings and loan, and probably the timberland too. There was some action around timberland, but it certainly wasn't attractive for the manufacturing base. So,
but again, I think I'm seeing again that conflict between an ownership class, you know, family run business operation, and the new management class, where you have to report to public shareholders. And you know that term you hear all the time: maximize shareholder value. And it's quicker returns. It's things that look good right now, where you don't necessarily have the staying power. I know Mr. Temple talked a lot about timber, forest, and having stay. You know, you can make money with trees, but you have to have staying power.
Yeah.
And the markets just don't support that. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, it's. I think as a broad statement, that's a fair assessment, Jonathan. I think it all comes down to people, okay, and how you view the world and what you're trying to accomplish. There are plenty of public companies that are managed for the long term, okay? You know, there are... I think our management, and I'm going to be critical of this, you know, I think our leadership at the time used the shareholder as a proxy to do whatever they wanted to do and whatever was convenient, okay? Or in some cases, whatever made them the most money, personally.
Corporations didn't exist for the benefit of the shareholder. Corporations existed for the benefit of the directors.
Not just directors, the management to some degree.
Okay.
Now, I don't want to be hypocritical here. I was one of the managers, so. But I can remember on more than one occasion, you know, having a discussion with Kenny about, you know, he would say, you know, the shareholders, that's the most important thing. You got to take care of the shareholders, and that's where we get our money to operate. You know, that drives the stock price. And I told him, I said, well, I guess my philosophy is this, and I think this is the Temple philosophy, said in a later day. You take care of your employees. They'll take care of your customers. The customers will take care of the company, and the company can take care of the shareholders. If you start at the shareholder, mm-hmm. right, then just about anything you want to do, you can say, well, that's not in the best interest of the shareholders, or it is in the best interest of the shareholders. And what's a shareholder? And let me tell you, in today's world and in the world we were living in then, a shareholder falls in and out of love very quickly. Okay? You can't chase Wall Street because, you know, there was a period where, you know, they said you got to sell all your timberland. Okay? And so everybody did it. And are these companies stronger today because they did it? I don't think so. Some of them didn't sell all of it. They sold some of it. You know, we had lots of discussions about that.
And I want to get into that, too, when we get to that point about, because I know some companies created their own TMOs and REITs instead of just...
Well, Georgia Pacific did that, but they lost control, okay? Yeah, yeah. Now, that was for the shareholders, because if you were they had the timber company, but the timber company got sold to Plum Creek, right? I mean, so Georgia Pacific's timberland, that's what's driving Plum Creek today. There was a lot of different, as the British say, schemes that were put together. But here's my view. On one hand, you know, I think Clifford always said, we don't run this company for the shareholders. I mean, you know, for Wall Street, right? We don't run it for Wall Street. We run it for the long term of the company. After a while, that got, again, in my opinion, at least, that got to be a proxy for whatever move you needed to make, whatever short-term move you needed to make, or whatever you wanted to do, you could do it because you could always say that's in the best interest of the shareholders, whether you really knew that or not. So I think back to your point about this change from a ownership to a public company, you know, I think part of that mindset is what changed. You know, I think the culture... I think I said this in the other session, what Bill Oates said about this being a special company, because it was built on values, principles, and beliefs. And I think over time, that shareholder, public company thing started changing that. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think in today's world you can be totally the other way, the ownership way, you know. But I think we didn't kind of strike the right balance. So if you go back to, you know, kind of where we were in this chronology, you know, now Temple Inland, you know, in the 90s, there's a bank, there's paper, okay? We are getting ready to sell Evadale, you know, in the early 2000s, and just be brown paper and building products, which is where Forest was
embedded. So what you mean by brown paper? Just...
Well, linerboard.
Linerboard.
Linerboard, right, and the box plants. And Evadale made white paper. They made file folder and paper cup, and they spent all the money, you know, they spent the $500 million, $600 million, whatever the number turned out to be, on a new paper machine down there to run really high-grade white paper for cigarette boxes and medicine boxes. And
Evadale,
right.
Right.
And, you know, that was not successful. And
Would you care at some point, I don't want to get away from the chronology too much, but to talk about that, what happened at Evadale? I know that's a little... out of maybe your direct involvement, but I understand there were some pretty significant projections based on 4 or 5 years of tremendous profitability, mm-hmm. and they ran with that. And once the ball got rolling, I think the end was in sight, and it wasn't too good looking, but it was too big a ball to stop immediately.
Yeah, I think... I think that's right. And here's kind of my recollection of that. In most business cycles, what we saw was if building products was down, paper was up. When we just had Evadale, for instance, okay? And obviously, the paper mill could make a lot of money. I mean, there were years it made $100 million, and for Temple Inland at the time, that was a lot of money. And as I said, we saw this growth in building products. We saw, you know, the capital being spent there, plants added and stuff. And Evadale was kind of sitting there. I think they felt like, or maybe the company felt like, they weren't kind of getting their fair share. They were one mill. They didn't acquire any more mills and stuff. And again, we had a management change there. We had the same week that Henry Hollebeck resigned, earlier that week, the mill manager in Evadale had died in his sleep.
Who was that?
His name was Tom Tutter.
Tutter.
He died on a Sunday night. Henry resigned on Thursday. And they put a guy named David Ashcraft, a young paper engineer, over Evadale. And it was, you know, David was, we want to grow. And this is not meant as criticism of David. So, you know, this expanding Evadale, adding a paper machine, started taking root in the company. And it took a while for that to continue to grow. I remember the board presentation. And I think the weaknesses were that David was kind of a young, inexperienced manager. We were more focused on manufacturing than sales. And we were going to spend this $500 million or so on a new paper machine to make this higher grade paper, which had a much bigger margin. And in the presentation, it was that we were going to go from not making any of it to making, you know, X number of tons with this margin, and it had to make a lot of money to have a return on the 600 million. And I don't remember exactly what it was, and it got above that, I think, by the time things were done. And so I think there were two failures in the project. One, we were trying to build a mill, a machine, a huge, huge construction project adjacent to and intertwined with a running large mill. And it was a nightmare, I think, okay, to get all that done. And you had an organization down there that had not done anything like that in a, maybe forever. And so they knew how to run the mill that they had to run, but they were having to run it and power changes and water, you know, it was a huge situation. You know, Jonathan, one of the things we used to talk about in building products around construction and these kind of things, and was, you know, people will say, well, you know, it takes a long time to turn this battleship, right? To turn, change directions and stuff. It's very complicated, very hard. And that's true, right? It is true. And you have to kind of lean into it, if you will. But a more complicated thing than that is like having the capability to change an engine on an airplane while it's in flight. And basically, that's what they were trying to do at Evadale. On the manufacturing side, they were trying to change. It was as complicated as changing the engine on a commercial airliner while it was in flight. And it takes great systems and processes and stuff to be able to do that. Having said that, on the other side, and I think in most things in our businesses, the world that I was involved in, you have to get the marketing right. You have to be able to sell the stuff. You have to have good quality products and all that. And when the mill started running the paper, it was not as easy to go sell that higher grade as they thought it was going to be. People didn't leave their Mead Westvaco was a big supplier of this stuff. They didn't leave them to come to this new deal, even though we may be making a better paper. You know, so what you had then, you'd spent all this money. You were not as efficient as you said running, and you couldn't sell enough of it. And that is a witch's brew of bad things to happen. So we had, the investment had gone way up, okay? The earnings were flat at best and generally down. And so your ROI looked awful. And it was a big burden on Temple Inland. $600 million of debt, and maybe it wasn't all debt, but we took on a lot of debt. And it was, it was a project that got a lot of attention from Wall Street, and because it wasn't successful, probably kept a lot of pressure on the stock price. And in fact, as I understood it later, when Kenny Jastrow talked to the board about him running, the company, the number one thing he told them was that he would sell Evadale. Get out of it. And the board by that time was ready to hear that. And to his credit, he was able to do it. Midwest Vaco bought the mill. We took probably $100 million, $150 million write-down on the sale, but we got out of it. And
stopped the bleeding?
Pardon?
Stopped the bleeding?
Stopped the amount of debt we had and the fact that it wasn't successful. Now with that, and we can talk about that when we get to Forest, we did make them a long-term fiber supply agreement, because they wanted wood from our forest and our mills. So, we got out of the Evadale thing in the early 2000s, and I think it was, at the time it was, Jonathan, the right thing to do would have been to fix it and have it be a part of earning and doing all the things it said. But by that time, and I think David Ashcraft was gone by then, it was the only thing to do, I think. It had turned into, as Mr. Temple used to say, a tar baby. And they're hard to get loose from, so we got out of it. And it was a clean break, and Temple Inland, didn't have that anymore. So, Mr. Temple was talking once, and he was talking about how he wasn't for Evadale, and he didn't think we should have spent that money, and he would have not spent it, and just if it was going to end, just let it end, if it was going to run out of gas, in a sense. And I said, well, Mr. Temple, I happened to be in that board meeting, and you voted for it. I watched you to see how you voted when it came up. And he said, oh, hell yeah, I voted for it. I didn't want to be disruptive. And I told him he'd already been disruptive talking against it, But anyway, those are the, that's kind of the way things happen in companies. And, Jonathan, I went to the executive program at Stanford in 1988. And in one of the classes, they talked about, sometimes you make good decisions and get bad outcomes. Sometimes you make bad decisions and get good outcomes. So you're not assured of, what's going to happen. I'm not sure that doing something major at Evadale was a bad decision, but it led to a bad outcome. So, we couldn't fix it. And that happened to us sometime in building products, that later we'll talk about MDF plants that we bought that we, had to turn around and sell and stuff.
Well, let me ask you this, and if it's getting us too far away from the chronology, we can come back. But you mentioned you were at this particular board meeting where the subject was another group, another side of the business. How do these board meetings work? For instance, you're representing your group. Everybody else is there. Do y'all have a lot of input? Can you say, hey, I don't think y'all need to be doing that, even though that's not your group? Or how is a consensus formed? And is it ultimately CEO's decision? Clifford Grom's, was it ultimately his decision? His leadership or what?
In any group of people, first of all, the management teams of the different groups that went to board meetings and made reports and stuff, you had no vote. No, you didn't participate in the discussions. Somebody might ask you a question, but David Ashcraft got asked questions about that, and he would answer them. But Harold didn't ask any questions, and I didn't ask any questions and stuff. And any group of people, they're kind of leaders emerge, right? And that's the way it is in a board. Certainly when Mr. Temple was in the board meetings. People looked at him to see which way he was leaning. A lot of work is done before the board meeting. You know, and Jastrow was the best at this. Usually, you come to a board meeting, the board is pretty pre-positioned, okay, to go along with what management is wanting.
There's not going to be any surprises.
There better not be any surprises at board meetings. That's okay. Right. Everybody better be fully up to speed. So the board meeting generally started with each group making a presentation about their results. Okay, quarterly results. Here's what we did for the quarter. Then the chief financial officer would roll all that up into a presentation for here's how the company did. Now later, those financial reports were all done by the CFO. He rolled it up, and you kind of gave a report on the state of the business. And you didn't do it every business. But you looked at the financials then. And then there was usually one topic, sometimes two, but generally one, that was a special report to the board. It may be about financing timberland sales. It may be about a possible acquisition. It may be about a capital project, a big capital project that you were doing, like the Evadale project was finally presented. It was talked about a little bit at the board, but it was all laid out at one board meeting. And you know, the board has been talked to by the chairman or CEO, and they'll ask a few questions, and then somebody will make a motion. And there's sometimes some discussions, and some board members will go three meetings and never ask a question. Other board members will ask a question about everything that comes up. So it's just a normal group dynamic of people that have run companies and should have some business experience and should ask good questions. But they get to be pretty routine, kind of the same. You know, okay, got the board meeting. Well, got to do your financial, do your slides. The slides, they try to keep them in the same form so it'll be familiar. Somebody, again, no surprises, right? They have the book before you come, and the board book will give a write-up for the business, how it did. It'll have its financials, all those things. And if there's a special report or something, it'll say verbal report. It won't be written up. But the way we did our board presentations, you had it. Leading up to a board meeting, there was a lot of preparation, because if I had a presentation to make, I had to, you know, with the management team around, I had to go through that. I had to read it. And Clifford got to a point where any board presentation was written out. He had heard it. He had made suggestions. It had been changed. And sometimes it had to get changed 10 times before you stood up in front of the board and made the presentation.
Now, Clifford could have been having conversations and meetings with the board before the meeting itself.
He would have phone conversations and that kind of stuff. He wouldn't have meetings with the whole board, right. But he would talk to key directors and generally try to make sure if there was anything big coming up, let them know how he felt about it, or made them comfortable that he had done his homework and that, you know, he was for it.
So the management then reports to Clifford, and you know, y'all get your ducks in a row, and you're ready and you're prepared, and then it's presented to the board.
That's right.
And so Clifford runs the meeting.
Clifford
all
runs the
groups,
meeting.
Make their presentations.
Right.
Clifford then asks the board, what's the direction?
Right. And okay. That's voted on, and they either approve it or disapprove it.
I've only been on public entity boards, and I know we have to do everything. You know, we can, you know, the Open Meetings Act and things like that. Now, that's public positions. Are there any special rules? What? I mean, I know that specifically doesn't apply to private organizations,
right.
But not private organizations, but business groups.
Well, there are minutes made.
Right.
You know, you kind of go by the traditional Robert rules of order. They'll ask for approval of the minutes from the last meeting.
I mean,
meeting.
Clifford and the board could be talking any and meeting, and I mean, are they free to do whatever they want to do?
Absolutely.
Okay, they don't.
And they'll go into executive session where we all would leave, the management team would leave, except for Clifford and a lawyer and the lady, you know, kind of taking the notes in the executive session. They get committee reports, You know, there are, we didn't hear those. Those came in executive session. So the Management Development Committee would report. You know, they give theirs. The Audit Committee gives a report because there's an Audit Committee meeting, and you know, before. Then they go into a session of just the board. And Clifford or
management,
all management leaves, right? And they have a, and that's growing, where boards get managers out. You know, they're having now lead directors, where there's one director that is a liaison between the board, the outside directors of the board, and the chairman of the CEO. So this lead director is a more powerful thing, and it's supposed to be a little bit of a governor or a break on the chairman, and also to let him know what the board's feelings are about things, right? Make sure there's a little better dialogue. But no, shareholders can't go and see the minutes or the discussions of the meetings, and it's it's a very business-like feeling in the board meeting, but it's also open to give and take. And I'll tell you some stories later about what happened when in the board meeting where the office was going to move to Austin.
I'd like to talk about the land sales and all that at some point.
And that's a whole different story. That's a very interesting piece. And I was involved in enough of that to know. But it's amazing how that happened.
Would you know? Decisions of, okay, this is what we're going to give the 4-star, this is what we're going to sell. You know, I've just always envisioned, you know, how did that play out? I mean, you know, in this specific planning of selection of lands and things like that.
Well, that's not hard. That was easy to do. But, now you're jumping way ahead. You're jumping to 2007 when you get to there. So,
let's go back to...
You know, if we're still back in the... You know, in the end of Clifford's time as running the company, second thing that Kenny told the board he would do, sell Evadale, fix paper, okay, fix Inland, because it wasn't doing well, and grow building products, because we were. Those are the three things he told them that.
And his background was LIC.
He actually went to work for LIC in 1969 and was there. He and Wayne McDonald were there together. They didn't ended up not having a very good relationship. Kenny left in the late 80s, and that's a story in and of itself, and then came back. Clifford bought the mortgage company that he had started up. He and some other guys had started up. It had gone broke, and Clifford bought it and hired Kenny back, and he ended up running the company and stuff later. So, it was a very very good decade for building products. A very good 15 years for building products, where we had all the resources we need. We had a supportive board. We made a lot of money. You know, our returns were always among the top in the company. We got to the point where we could make enough money to be significant. And embedded in all that was the forest. And, so building products at the time, you know, there was kind of the bank, the Inland, and building products. And building products was an equal partner in there because it had forest in it. So when you say building products, or maybe we should say forest products, you know, our investment was $1 billion. There was about $1 billion invested over here and in paper. And in the bank, it was much less than $1 billion, but it was growing. So the temple part of it. And Jonathan, again, one of the things that separated Temple from other forest products companies, I think, was that in those other companies, paper people had the power, ran the company, because they were, I mean, that was the driver, right? International paper, they made their money in paper mills, right? here, we were basically run by Mr. Temple, Joe Denman. We were run by building products people. We were run by people who didn't put paper in front of everything. Even Clifford wasn't a paper guy. He was a financial guy, right? Mm-hmm. So up until, you know, again, I'm jumping way ahead. Up until the breakup of the company, Temple Inland was never a paper company. It was a very different kind of company. Now, after the breakup and what was left, it was a paper company. So, you know, we came out of the 90s with a whole different asset base and really a great story to tell in building products. 2.1 million acres of timberland underneath our mills, okay? The fifth largest forest in the U.S. South and the seventh largest forest in the United States. And that grew, privately owned farm, that grew from that base of 500,000 acres that Temple had built up over time. And it was built by people who saw the value of forest. And look, when Clifford paid $300 million for Owens, Illinois, and got that forest land, he got a paper mill out of it that wasn't doing very well. He got that. He spent that money for the long term. He wanted the forest land. I mean, that was, you know, it was within our company. You knew that was good, and it was within ours. But it didn't have an immediate return. You know, the forest, now we cut more, granted, off once we had the Owen, Illinois forest. But those were long-term investments, you know. I mean,
so. Yeah, it was still the same thought process of the 1930s. Yeah, basically,
you know, when we bought the Cavenham Forest in, we paid $90 million for it, okay? And Clifford didn't have to do that. I mean, it didn't help earnings greatly. It tied up $90 million. It did all that. But, you know, he did it and to build that fiber base, to continue to do that, very much like you just said, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Arthur Temple Sr. had to sell about 90,000 acres during the Depression. And he, you know, we have his letters. I mean, he agonized over that. Mm-hmm. He hated to do that, but he had to. But as soon as they were able to buy more, they more than replaced it. The lands that they gave or sold to become part of the Big Thicket Preserve, you know, they took that money and bought lands elsewhere. So again, yeah, that was the thought process.
Well, sure.
Grow your timber along with everything else. Well,
we lost 30 or 40,000 acres in the lake.
Yeah.
You know? And... But there again, you know, they did that for the... What would East Texas be today without Sam Rayburn? You know? What a great asset that is to have. Water and stuff. If the company had not taken the longer view and knowing that they were going to get something for the land and they could go, you know, they'd reinvest. But that was just the way they did things. They did things for the longer term. And the lake, in a sense, was for the long term good. They knew that everything we had would benefit from that, right?
I think much of Rayburn was Kurth land. And the Kurths, at least in the newspapers, were very adamant opposed to it. And you don't really see much from Temple. One, I don't think they had as much land, but I think you know, that sort of was the beginning of the end of Angelina County Lumber Company and their operations, because they pretty much lost most of their timber reserve.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that was also that period, you know, we talked about those transition years. The 30s was a big change, and the 60s was the other change. That's when you had, the Camden operation, the end of family-run businesses,
right.
And Temple was able to sustain through that third generation,
right.
and continue that on.
That's
so,
right.
So, again, you know, it's a lot of big... picture concepts going on during that.
Absolutely. And in our case, in Temple's case, you know, it revolved around the leadership of one man.
Yeah.
It got us through that. Because, like, I think I started this by saying that there were literally hundreds of family-owned, even though the story about Mr. Murphy, you know, family-owned sawmill, owned some timberland, run the mill, you know. That's what happened, and most of them today are gone.
Right. And the ones, just for the record, what we were talking about was the Kurth family with Angelina Kane Lumber Company and the Carter family, W.T. Carter family.
Those are gone.
And, you know, those were just as big, if not bigger, than the Dye Ball and Piling operation, you know, during their heydays, you know, during those
Early
boom days.
You know, Kirby.
And then there was Kirby with 14 sawmills.
Mm-hmm.
Largest lumber supplier in the world is what they touted themselves as, certainly in the South.
And it would have been great if we could have bought Kirby, but, you know, Louisiana Pacific had to divest a bunch of timberland on the West Coast, and they had a bunch of government money, and they could pay more than anybody. And you know, I know we would have liked to have had you know that fiber base and those mills. So, like I said, John.
Well, you did wind up with the Houston Oil Company lands, which was part of Kirby's genesis.
Yeah, but that was before.
Right.
That was long before.
Right.
Yeah, but. You know, it's like I said, Mr. Temple got the big things right. He missed on some little things. And, you know, he used to tell me he shut down more businesses than most people ever started up. But he got the big things right. And the big thing was probably not selling to Champion, which I think, again, they wanted to find out what it was worth. But finding a way to do something like the Time Inc. deal, which was the first big stepping stone to what turned out to be the spinoff, you know, or the out of time, where it really came out then strong enough, you know, like we talked. It had Inland, it had Evadale, it had the Timberlands, and even though it didn't have the $2 million then, you know, inside Inland there was that Georgia Craft piece. It was, you know, another in those transformational steps of the company that allowed it to, you know, to end up where it ended up, you know. So those are the things, those are the big things that he got right. And you can make the case later that leadership didn't get the big things right, and that led to the end of the company. Now, you know, if you set Mr. Jastrow down here today, he would say, we did it right. We did it for the shareholders. Icon was going to get us and take us over and tear us up and all that. So, you know, we kind of end up now at the transition from Clifford Grum into Kenny Jastrow's leadership, you know, that starts around the turn of the century there. And you know, we had some new energy in Temple. Kenny brought that. You know, he's like me. The first year, we're almost the same age, exactly. First year of the baby boomers, you know, in a sense, to some degree, different, not different values, but a different view of the world. Had been handed a company, hadn't really seen it built. Even though he says he did, because he was he'd been there a long time, you know, but he didn't understand manufacturing. He didn't want anything to do with it. He liked the financial side, really enjoyed being CEO, and I think that's another. There were several steps in this cultural change that led to the 2007 decision, and then. You know, of course we had, you know, we had 9/11 and we went through another pretty tough period in the overall building products, cycle, started coming out of it in 2003 and, you know, powered all the way through what turned out to be the housing bubble, in a sense there, that period got to be the shrinking of building products to some degree. We shut down, we made some acquisitions in the very late 90s and right at the end of Harold's time running the company. Some of those turned out not to be very successful. The Mount Jewett particle board plant had to be shut down, Clarion MDF plant, Clarion, Pennsylvania MDF plant was sold, the Pembroke, Canada MDF plant was sold. We did those in the 2003 through 2006 period. So we kind of went, we went up from like the 17 core plants to, you know, about 20 or 21 plants, and then over time shrank that back to the 17 that we had. But through all that, Jonathan, I remember when I was, you know, running building products, all of it, there was a lot of pressure at first in 2003 especially about why we weren't making any money. And we did hit a period there where we lost money a couple of years. But I remember telling the board that, you know, what we had was a core group of plants, the core group of Temple Inland plants and building products plants were all doing okay. They were going through the cycle, either breaking even or losing a little money or making a little money. It was the plants we had acquired, and the El Dorado joint venture, the particle board MDF plants that were causing the losses. And happily, we fixed John McClain and some of his guys fixed El Dorado, and we shut the particle board plant down in Mount Jewett, and we sold the other two plants. And then we had better markets, and then that's when we really started doing well. And from 03, built to 04, 05, 06, and then hit the wall again with this when the housing bubble burst in 07. And have been through and remain in the longest downturn in housing in the country, in the history. We started keeping records on housing in 1959. I mean, you know, housing starts, all those things. And I showed the board a history of that. And then I realized when I looked at it, I started in 70. So this chart ran from 1959 to 2000. And I guess I showed them this in 2008 or 9. And I realized that from 59 to, you know, the period we're talking about, it was like 50 years. And I'd been working 40 of those years. So I had lived through most of those cycles. So, you know, Clifford retires, Kenny takes over. There is a lot of new energy. We're going to grow the company. We're going to do all these great things. And, but we had problems, you know, sell Eva Dale. That made the company smaller. But after that, we bought Gaylord Container, which had one paper mill in Bogalusa, Louisiana, and in numerous box plants. But we were doing things, Jonathan. We were buying box plants when we didn't need to buy box plants. Most of them now have been in the last stages of Temple Inland were shut down. We're spending big money there because Mr. Jastrow didn't understand integration, and he was copying Willamette's approach to markets.
Spell that.
Willamette Forest Products. They were They were very similar to Temple. They were West Coast and
Willamette, something like that. Willamette. Okay.
They were the Shields family. Was Shields S H.
Yes.
Okay. Family. They were the Temple family of Willamette. They ended up being bought by Weyerhaeuser. Okay? And Willamette and Temple, Union Camp, there was a Camp family. All those three made it a long way. And Union Camp is now part of IP. Willamette is part of Weyerhaeuser, and Temple's a part of IP. So we were really at the end of the road on these, you know, these things.
I guess Weyerhaeuser, they're still around, aren't they?
Weyerhaeuser's still around. Weyerhaeuser is kind of one of those companies that you kind of mentioned earlier that converted, they converted from a public company to a public timber REIT. And so they're a different animal than they were before.
By REIT, I guess for the record, it'd be the Real Estate Investment Trust.
Yes.
Okay. Not a timber investment management organization.
Right.
Not a REIT.
Plum Creek is a publicly traded timber REIT. Okay. Weyerhaeuser is a publicly traded timber REIT. Potlatch is a publicly traded timber REIT. The Campbell Group is a privately held timber investment management organization. Okay. RMS, Resource Management Services, is a privately held timber investment management company. So they're very different animals, but they're vehicles to hold timberland.
And we can get into that later, but I do want to address some of those with the accounting practices and, you know, about how timber can't appreciate or depreciate and how it looks on books and how shareholders look at that. And I guess that's some of that quote-unquote undervaluation. But then also the fact that the taxes, I know a lot of people have talked about that the timber is actually taxed twice. It's taxed in the forest, but it's also taxed at the time of manufacturing. Perhaps.
Right. No.
But I want to get into that at some point. Just whenever you think's the best time to do that.
Well, let's just drop back. We've kind of gotten up to the 2000s, and we're into the 2000s now. So we'll drop back and talk about that a bit. Jonathan, there was, and I may have mentioned it earlier, but from the 40s, 50s, a forest products company was an integrated company that had timberland, paper, and usually various grades of paper, okay, building products, and various building products manufacturing. And the integration was the tree, you know, you could thin trees, they could go to paper mills for pulpwood, you grew them to a saw timber deal, saw timber size, they go in a sawmill or a plywood plant, you make chips, bark, all that. That goes to the paper mill, you sell those products, you get the value of the trees. Everybody looked the same. In the decade of the 90s, things started changing in that the people, here again, this is Jack's view, the people running these companies, most of them, were paper people. And they viewed everything around the paper business, right? And I guess because there were projections of increased demand for paper. And in the late 80s, they made a lot of money. And a lot of that money came from forest, okay, earnings. And they overbuilt capacity going into the 90s. In fact, the paper industry earned its cost of capital for its shareholders 1 year in the 90s, 1995. Every other year, their earnings were so low that they didn't earn their cost of capital, which probably was, you know, 7%, 6, 7, 8%. I don't know exactly, but they didn't make that much money, okay? And so people, Wall Street started looking at them. What are you doing? You know, why aren't you making more money? Why'd you overbuild? Part of that answer was that you took the profits from your forest, right? The profits that forest made, and you spent it badly. You used the income from forest to build too much paper capacity or, you know, do crazy things with it. Okay? So that was one of the issues that developed. The forest money income is being badly used. It's giving you a mechanism to go overbuild in your paper business, and you're not making any money in there. Okay, so that's one. Two, they started looking around and saying, wait a minute. If you're Temple, and your stock's $22. I think we came on the market about $23 or something like that. But let's say it was $25. Your stock's $25. And you've got 2 million acres of forest land. Now, it may be on your books at $400 million. But if you say today, what's that really worth? And let's say it was worth, you know, that was, in our case, that was about $400 an acre. Okay? And part of the reason for that is that we got the inland forest, and it was on at $400 or more than that, but and the Texas forest was about $200 an acre on the books. So that's how you got the $500 million, you know, 2 million acres at $400 an acre, or 2 million acres at, well, we had on the books for $500 million. So, yeah, that's, why didn't it come out $400 million? A billion. It was our total investment. Let me think about that a minute. Well, we won't get bogged down in that. It was on the books for $400. It was about $400 an acre, is what it was on the books for. And, well, I guess it would be less than that. Yeah, it was less than that because it was, Georgia was 4 and Texas was 2. You put them together, and I guess that's something above 250 or so. So wait a minute. If that $400 million or $500 million investment on your books, it's really worth $1 billion. Why isn't that $500 million reflected in the price of the stock? You know, because if you got 100 million shares, why isn't the stock price $5 higher than that? You're not earning enough on your forest, even though you're taking the earnings and sticking it over here. So we started running into this twofold deal with forest products companies. You've overbuilt using money that you shouldn't have used, okay, coming from forest. And the value of the forest, the current value of the forest, is not reflected in the price of the stock. And a more efficient way to hold that for the shareholder, okay, is sell it and give the money to the shareholder, right? Just, and then put it over here where it's not double taxed, where it's, you know, the tax on the timber REIT is most of its capital gains for the investor, right? And so that pressure grew, okay? And to do something with this forest land. Well, Clifford was very protective of the forest and really didn't talk about it a lot, those things, trying to take a very low profile on it. Because I think he knew those things. He knew that, you know, the value of our forest wasn't really reflected in the price of the stock. So you not only, you needed to make more money and you need to get it shown in the value of the stock. And for a while, the defense against selling your forest for the companies was, well, if we sell it, we're going to have to pay all these taxes on it. And, you know, if we sell it, if it's on the books for $400 and you sell it for $1,000 an acre, right? So you got that $600 gain, and you're going to pay 40% of that in taxes. So the shareholder is not going to benefit that much. It's an inefficient sale. So, you know, we're going to do better, and we may sell some. We're going to make more money on it. We're not going to invest the profits badly, but we're not going to sell it, okay? And I will, and that was, you know, other than GP doing the timber company, which didn't really create a lot of value for GP shareholders and stuff, but it kind of died down, this deal to sell the forest, right? And during that time, International Paper was acquiring Union Camp, Champion, da 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 da. And at one time, International Paper owned 12 million acres of timberland. 12 million acres. And what they started doing very quickly.
They weren't seeking to buy timber. They just came with those other acquisitions.
Yeah, right. You know, that integrated model again.
They
just
found out, hey, we've got all this land.
You know, Champion had 1 million acres here and more someplace else. And Union Camp had 1.5 million acres. And Federal Paper Board had 500,000 acres. And
they were wanting the paper, not the other stuff.
Yeah. But
just like when they got Temple Inland.
So they started selling about 1 million acres a year very quietly. Some of it to TIMOs, some of it to adjacent landowners, some of it to other forest products companies, and that was kind of how they were managing earnings. IP's earnings were pretty steady because they were just selling timberland. And in fact, over a five-year period, they sold 5 million acres of timberland. They sold down to where when they sold all their timberland, they had just over, they had 7 million acres, something like that, of which they sold six and kept 6.2 million and kept about 800,000. They didn't sell all of it at one time. So this integrated forest products model started unwinding. Okay? A little bit here, a little bit there. This is a...
How much pressure was Temple feeling even before Icon came along in that regard?
Well, I went to Forest in 96, and we started looking at Forest differently then. There was some pressure, but not a lot. We were certainly saying, we're not going to sell this because we got such a low basis in it. It's not efficient. And the pressure was kind of abating a bit, okay? There wasn't a lot of stuff going on.
So you didn't spend a whole lot of time really looking at or thinking about it.
Oh, I spent a lot of time doing it because I felt like we had to, our defense was for our forest to make more money. And in order to do that, that wasn't just cut more trees. We had to, you know, we were always going to focus on environmental and stuff. But we had to make more money. And that led to looking at high-value land. You asked about Forestar earlier. We started looking at Georgia differently. And what we realized over there is we had a lot of land around Atlanta. And we were able to take that land and sell it to a developer. You know, we weren't doing a lot, but we were selling it for $4,000 or $5,000 an acre and for them to build houses on and stuff. So that started evolving. I mean,
more value as real estate than timber growing land.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way Atlanta was growing, it was, you know, growing out. It was nothing to have a subdivision 50 miles outside of Atlanta and somebody driving in.
I guess in a smaller way, that's really what Temple was doing with Sabine Investment Company in the 60s.
Sure.
Was looking at lands around the lakes and things that, and Crown Colony and all this, where
absolutely,
where it now has a different value as real estate land, you know, traditional real estate rather than just timber growing land.
Well, you know, right here in East Texas, you can take a county road that we own land on the road frontage, okay? And again, it was on the books for $200 an acre, and you could go plat it differently and with very little trouble. You know, sell 2 acre lots all along the road or 5 acre lots. And that's exactly what East Texas wanted. And you'd sell those for $2,500 an acre or something like that. And so somebody looked at it and said, well, golly, I'm going to build a $80,000 house. So, you know, what's $5,000 for, or $6,000 for 3 acres of land? Okay. But for Temple, that was, you know, $2,000 an acre.
The interesting thing about it was a lot of the money that came through Sabine Investment, where did it go? It went back to buying more timber growing land.
Yeah. You know,
in some cases.
The thing about Sabine, it sounded good, and yeah, but you know, I remember once Mr. Temple, he was very upset about a deal that Sabine had done, just like I described, on the road out to Boggy Slough. They had done that and stuff. And he says, you know, Jack, he said, how much money did they make on that? Okay? So, you know, let's say they sold, I don't know, maybe 10 of those little tracts at 2 acres each. So that's 20 acres. And, you know, okay. So they sold them for $5,000 an acre. Okay? So that's $100,000. It's like he said, that's not a decimal point on Temple Inland's earnings. Not a decimal point. And what do you get? Mobile homes, trashy deals, you know. You don't control it very well if you're going to do that. So, you know, that was another mixed bag, you know. But it was a proper thing to do. One of the things I left out in my kind of track through here, there was a brief period there before I became vice president of operations that I was going to move to Forest and report to Mr. Denman and to Wayne McDonald, but I was going to build a program of small land sales and trades with other forest products companies to block up the lands, and if we had lands that we didn't really need, non-strategic lands, to put together programs to sell those to adjacent landowners and stuff, which I thought would be a lot of fun. And then Harold messed it up and asked me to be vice president of operations, and I did that. But yeah, we always did that. You had to work that. That was part of the, you know, acquisition and selling and stuff. So that got to be a big part of if you're going to hold this land base. How do you, a forest. We used to say it's not a static asset. It's a living, breathing, changing. You know, you can sell this, buy this, grow this, conserve this, do this. So there's a lot of different shades to a forest that you have to manage. And before I forget, Jonathan, I mentioned environmental and forgetting forest. This was a personal belief of mine, and I think I learned this from Glenn Chancellor and, you know, the people that came before us here. Well, I don't know if I've said this or not in the earlier deals, but you know, when I went to Run Forest, I told you Mr. Burke sent me a letter, Ward Burke, a handwritten note on a piece of yellow legal paper. He'd retired long ago by then. He said, I'm glad you're running the forest. You know what the land means to the company. Now don't disappoint us. You know, it's one of the more frightening things that ever been told. But I used to tell our guys, I'm a big believer in language and how people prioritize things, and it says a lot about what you're going to do. If you took a forester from Louisiana Pacific and a forester from Temple, and you said to each one of them, ask them the same question, tell me the three most important things you do in your job. Okay? And they both answered it exactly the same way. But they answered it like this. The guy from LP says, I get wood for the mills. I meet environmental standards and I grow the forest. Okay? And the guy from Temple says, I grow the forest, I meet environmental standards, and I get wood for the mills. Okay? They said exactly the same three things, right? But the order in which they say them, the priorities in which the companies drive that, okay, totally different jobs. Totally different jobs. Because if you're a forester and doing procurement, and your number one job is to get wood for that paper mill, you know, you don't have the same priority as that guy from Temple who says, my number one job is to grow this forest. Okay? My number two job is to do correct things environmentally. And then I'll get wood for the mill. Okay? It's a totally different culture, totally different approach to how you're managing that thing. And we kept those priorities, you know. And growing the forest was, you know, all about sustaining what we had. And a close second to that was to meet the environmental standards that we had to meet. So, you know, this unwinding of the forest products industry the from the 90s stuff, led to this, you know, sell the forest. Now, I said the pressure had dropped on selling the forest and that, and we were working as hard as we could to tell a story about how we were managing it. We were going to sell lands over here, buy land here, meet environmental standards, harvest what we could harvest, get the right wood to the right mill, which added more value and stuff. I came to work and I picked up the paper and I saw that Louisiana Pacific was going to sell their forest using what was called an installment note. Installment notes were developed for agriculture land sales, and forest land fell in that agriculture land sale. And an installment note allowed you to delay the taxes that you would pay. And now it became, on the short term again, a more efficient transaction. So you couldn't say anymore, I'm not going to sell it because we pay too much taxes. Temple Inland sold our forest using installment notes. Okay? If you looked at Temple Inland's balance sheet after that sale, there was a long-term liability there for taxes of about $700 million. But it wasn't due for 19 years or some period like that. But it is due. But the rating agencies and the credit agencies and stuff didn't consider that as debt. They thought you'd have plenty of time to, you know, account for it and deal with it. When that happened, that became the way to sell forest land. Then the pressure grew again, and most people started selling their forest land. Okay? Now, you know, we still resisted. Okay? Our reaction of breaking up the company was not so much to that. That was a vehicle, though, that meant you could sell it, right? And you'd get a lot of money when you sold it. You wouldn't have to pay taxes. So when Icon came back the second time, that was a component of, and a major component of, breaking up Temple Inland. Because given the debt we had at the time and stuff, you couldn't have broken up the company and kept the forest. You didn't have, we didn't have, and the only way you were going to pay a special dividend to the shareholders to make Icon go away, or to help make him go away, was to sell the forest. That was the asset, that was the most, because of installment notes and the money that was out there that would invest in forest land, that was the most liquid asset we had. More liquid than the bank.
So this deferred tax, IP owes that, right? I mean, when they bought Temple Inland, they bought into all that.
Sure, but they've got a much bigger nut like that than we do, because they sold $6 million under installment
for a year.
Right. Yeah. Well, the other that they sold, they were just selling that land, paying the taxes on it. Those weren't necessarily sold through installment notes. They did a couple of joint venture type deals and stuff, but the big deal was when they sold the $6 million at the end, and when they sold, you know, kind of got out of the forest business.
So is it still the same amount of tax, just deferred, or?
Yeah, it's okay. Just deferred.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's what's wrong with America now.
It's just,
we're deferring everything.
Yeah, we're deferring.
We're deferring all the hard stuff.
But that's when the pressure grew back to do something with the forest.
Wow.
I remember, I clearly remember my heart sinking when I saw that, the LP deal, because I knew that would start the drumbeat over, and it did.
So that was your job then to look at that, to
sure. Sure, I think that one of the changes that was made, and I give Harold most of the credit for this, but Clifford went along with it. Harold had been involved. Glenn kind of reported to Harold and to Clifford, you know, more directly to Clifford, but with a dotted line to Harold. And he saw that there was value in having a business person run the forest if you had the right, you know, values yourself versus another forester running it. And that's why I got to go to forest, and, you know, we were asked to take cost out and change the management culture and ensure that we did the right things, you know, on the ground, and to look at forest, you know, from a financial standpoint. I remember Glenn would report in meetings, you know, there's always a forest report. They talk about ROI, and Glenn's ROI was always...
And that's return on investment.
Return on investment was always, you know, 13, 14, 15% every quarter. Very stable. And so I go down to forest, and, you know, Glenn was wonderful to help in the transition and stuff. And actually, I was kind of there. He was there about 6 months while I was down there, and then he left and continued to be, you know, helpful even after he left. And Harold came in one day after Glenn had been gone for a while, end of a quarter. He said, "Well, how'd you do?" And I said, "We had a 14% return." He says, "Is that at book or market?" And I said, "Well, that's at book." He said, what would it be if it was at market? If you valued the forest at market and looked at the earnings you had off of it. I said, well, shoot, Harold, if you look at it at market, it's about a 5% return. He said, 5% is not good enough. And he said, we're not going to look at forest at book value anymore. We're going to look at it at market. And the difference was if you said that, these other transactions were taking place at $750, $800, $900 an acre. Okay, so if you've got, $250 and $900, on 2 million acres, that's a much bigger base to divide into those earnings. So it was an evolution of that kind of stuff. I must tell you a story about Glenn Chancellor. Glenn was an avid golfer, and loved to play golf at Crown Colony. And they, after he retired, they moved to Houston. But he would call in that period. When he was still calling all the time, he would say, well, everybody play golf this weekend, because he played in the weekends with them. Yeah. Well, how'd you play? Well, I didn't play very good or whatever, whatever. And he won't know how'd Gene Sanford play, how'd Harold play, just. And at Crown Colony on the 18th hole back then, there was a huge tree on the right side of the fairway out about 220 yards. And if you hit a good drive, you hit it past that tree. And you had to really hit it good to hit it past the tree, right? And so I'm talking to Glenn one day in this Monday conversation. Did you play? Yes, we played. How'd everybody play? How'd you play? I didn't play very well. I said, but boy, Glenn, I'm going to tell you. On 18, I said, I hit a drive. It was one of the best drives I've ever hit. I said, I hit it 20 yards past that oak tree on the right, the big oak tree on the right. And there was this pause, Jonathan. And he said, Sweeney, that's a hickory tree. And he said, in your new job, you need to know that. I made John Monk go look. I thought he was kidding me. John came back. He said, Jack, it's a hickory tree. So I did have to learn some things about forestry. But Glenn Chancellor was the sweetest man ever. And he cared about the forest and cared about the company. And it's just a shame, the tragic death after he retired. But I always... The tree is gone now. The tree died. But I never, hardly ever play 18 at Crown Colony. I don't think of Glenn Chancellor,
Now, yeah. I don't know if you would have known, but did he feel any pressure during his time?
Sure.
To sell?
Glenn.
Because some of these REITs and TIMOs, that trend started really in the 80s.
Yeah. Right? No, I think the pressure... See, I went in 96,
right.
Okay? So the pressure really started in the late 90s and in the early 2000s. Glenn knew about it, and he understood it. But no, I think Glenn felt more pressure about getting wood for the mills and growing the forest and... Glenn was there when we started talking about plantations, and that was a big subject within Temple. Are we going to go to a plantation forest, or how are we going to manage that? So I think he felt pressure from those operational things, more than the financial things.
Well, and he, I guess, was the first and maybe the only, I guess, where it wasn't a Temple person. And by Temple person,
that's right.
You know what I'm talking about.
Sure.
Glenn
ran the...
He came through Southwest.
Southwest, that's right.
And so, I guess prior to that, you had people like Dave Kinley and Kenneth Nelson. And I think Temple actually started doing some clear cutting about 71 or so. And it's mentioned in those annual reports to the stockholders. But there's a statement in there where, and in Arthur, we have some of his speeches too, Arthur Temple Jr., where he says it's just one string in our bow. Clear cut will work in some very selected places, but as the one fix all tool, it was totally wrong, and he was going to fight it.
Right.
And then I guess Glenn came along sometime after that, with the Time acquisition, 74, 75. But I'm kind of digressing myself now. But I asked Mr. Temple about that one time. I was thinking about this earlier when you were speaking. when you were talking about the markets, and you just can't quite, it's not that simple to say, well, the shareholders are demanding this. But I asked him about clear cutting and the decision to go to a predominant clear cut or plantation type forest. And it may have been that he just didn't want to talk about it, but he just dismissed it with, well, you know, once we, you know, were part of time, we had to do whatever the stock market demanded. And that was the end of it. He didn't really talk. And I'm sure there's a lot more to it than that. But
oh, I think so.
He just didn't really want to talk about it, but what he said.
I think that our competitors did it. And I think there was a financial case for doing it, Jonathan. And I think in that, too, was the fact that if you were going to get value out of the forest, you had to do it on certain sites. The difference was some people did it everywhere. You know, in Louisiana, for instance, some of the land over there are 2,000-acre clear cuts. 2,000 acres. Okay? Well, we didn't do that. And, you know, but it became even under Glenn, and I think, you know, Mr. Nelson was probably in some transition there. You kind of had to do it to keep up. I don't think that
well, the origins would have been the 69 public, you know, when the company went public in 69. And
I think that's
changing.
Yeah, I think he was just like I said, you could use the shareholders for anything you wanted to, anything you wanted to justify. You know, I never once, it's interesting to say, I never once heard Mr. Temple say we got to do something for the shareholders. I heard his predecessor say it a lot, yeah. You know. And you know, the world did change. But I think you had to farm the trees, and you had to grow them as fast as you could. If you do a net present value on, you know, what it costs to, just what we were doing, just replant, and say you're on a 40-year rotation, and you have to wait 40 years to get even that money back, even if you didn't do anything but just basic site prep and stick the trees in the ground. You know, those economics didn't look very good. Basically, what we had, Jonathan, you know, throughout the South, I mean, the forest had been cut very heavily, right? And it grew back. And by the 60s and in that time, we basically had God's forest, okay? I mean, that's what we were harvesting. Things that had been, you know, it had been cut. Nothing happened for 40, 45 years, and you had, you know, nature grew a forest. And you had to start converting. You kind of, see, man could overcut God's forest, right? I mean, we had gotten chainsaws and better tools and all that stuff, you know. And I think, because I was involved watching it very closely at the time, on the West Coast of the U.S., some of the issues around harvest levels out there and cutting the public forest and stuff, there was a time when man couldn't kind of overcome nature, right? You couldn't log it fast enough, right? I mean, when you were using oxen and axes and stuff, and the forest that was there, you know, as slow as it was to cut it down, it almost could grow back. I mean, out there it takes 100 years, but, you know, could kind of do that. But we got so mechanized, especially, you know, out there. You know, instead of cutting 10 trees a day with power saws and helicopters and skidders and all that, you could cut 1,000, you could cut 500 trees a day. And so you saw this huge base start doing this. And people that were sensitive to that started saying, time out. You know, you're going to cut this thing down. There's not going to be any of it left. And that forest was cheap. There was almost no cost in it. You know, nobody had planted it. Nobody, you know, it was God's forest. And the same thing kind of started happening in East Texas, that we started harvesting more bigger mills, you know, this thing. You know, for instance, when I first got to be vice president of operations, I think the Dieball sawmill, which was viewed to be a pretty good-sized sawmill, would run 75 million feet. 75 million board feet a year. Okay? And I'm not sure what Dieball ran. Well, let's just say this. In my time with Temple, it ran 180 million feet off the same footprint. Right? Mm-hmm. You've been here a long time. That mill's, the footprint of the mill is still on the same land, the same footprint that the mill built in 1894 was on. Okay? Ran 180 million feet. Okay? And all that filters back down to the forest because that's trees. You know, when you're running, I remember David Kellum, we were doing this work with Dr. Rapai about the natural life cycle of the forest. And we had the Buna sawmill then, which was, bigger than Dieball at the time. And David came in to me and he said, "Now, I want to be sure that I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to go to Buna, right? All right. I'm going to talk to the employees at the Buna mill, okay? And I'm going to tell them that we're, the work we're doing in forest and in the mills, that we're in enhancing the natural life cycle of the forest. Because that's what had come out of this research and stuff, that basically there is a life cycle to a forest, and all we're doing by cutting and processing, and then replanting, we're just enhancing, speeding up the natural life cycle of the forest. And let me go back to what David said. Now, I'm going to tell the employees at the Buna Mill that they're enhancing the natural life cycle of the forest at 15 logs a minute. Think of that, Jonathan. 15 logs a minute. That's what we were running through one side of the Buna sawmill. 15 logs a minute. Now, the forest life cycle is not, there, it's not producing under God's forest 15 logs a minute. So if you do plantation, I don't think it was the shareholders, but I think it was competition. I think it was utilizing the land. And if you did it right, and I think it's been proven now by things people said and that Temple did it right. And I think that it grew out of the kind of letter Mr. Burke, the note, out of the values that, people had, and out of the way Glenn helped manage that transition, because that's really what he did. Probably the biggest, I was kidding Glenn once when I was in operations. I said, we were talking about the amount of fiber we were using. I said, "Chancellor, I said, you probably cut down, been responsible for cutting down more trees in East Texas than any man alive." And he looked at me and smiled, "Jonathan." He says, "Yeah, that's probably right." But he said, "I've also planted more trees than anybody in East Texas." He was right about that too. Champion really led the way on this. You know, if you go down 59 now, you see all those plantations. I mean, those trees are 20, 25 years old, whatever. But they were really converting every acre they could to a plantation forest. And that's why today, East Texas, there were 4 million acres of land in southwest Louisiana and East Texas that were owned by four forest products companies. And every one of those acres that could be converted was converted to plantations. And that's why the wood basket in this part of the South is, in my opinion, still, it's the best wood basket left in the U.S. South. There are more trees coming. There are more plantations there. There's more saw timber to be produced here than just any place else I know. I don't know another 4 million acre block like this.
I did have a lot more questions about the forest. Did you want to go into that now? Or?
I've got about another probably 15 minutes.
Okay. Well, we've been talking big picture. This is something kind of specific, but I know a lot of people, certainly my generation and even older, remember the old billboard signs. You know, this is a Temple perpetual forest. Mm-hmm. That word perpetual. Selectively harvested since 1903, 1904.
Right.
I know that was part of a larger "We Want to Be a Good Neighbor"
right.
PR campaign. Well, I guess it started in the 70s, that billboard campaign. It ended sometime in the 90s, is that right? Or yeah. Somewhere in there? Was that when you were head of the forest? And what was that all about, I guess? And why did that end? Was it part of the conversion to plantation forest? Was it a PR, a good PR campaign that had run its course? Well,
I don't know. I don't have a recollection of why it ended, Jonathan. The practices on the ground didn't end.
Okay.
Maybe the ad deal. There was a lot of pressure. The reason we did this work we talked about is that the forest products companies were all under a lot of pressure. You know, you're whacking down the forest, you're industrial, you know, guys, you're just interested in a quick dollar. And I think those signs were meant to tell people that we were cutting this forest down, but there was going to be another forest go back in there, mm-hmm. right? Even if we were doing, and we did more select cutting and stuff. If you look at the economics on that, though, it doesn't work, right? It doesn't work as well as plantation. But, yeah, I mean, I think the message was that there was going to be another forest go back in there. There wasn't going to be a subdivision or, you know, if we cut it, we were going to replant it. So there was going to be more trees coming than there had been before. Now, the offset to that is it's a monolithic culture. You know, that's a point that Buddy always made. Yeah, okay, you're replanting trees, Buddy Temple. You're replanting trees, but they're all the same, right? There's not a diversity.
It's an even age.
It's an even age forest that doesn't have the diversity. It doesn't do that much for wildlife, you know, those kind of things. And those were real, you know, real valid questions and frankly hard questions to answer. About the only answer you had is yes, but we're leaving this over here. We're going to manage, you know, around it. We're going to have a diverse forest. We're not going to do the creek bottoms. We're going to do a mosaic. It's not all going to look like that. But, you know, in East Texas, we probably had, you know, a million of the 1,600,000 acres. By the time we sold the forest, there was probably 1,000,002 of that in plantations. You know?
Yeah.
Maybe 1,000,000. But, you know, it kept going, but there was much more sensitivity to the streamside management zones, appearance zones, that even when we went in and cut along the road, we did select this harvest there. We never clear cut it.
Right.
You know, we didn't aesthetic management zones.
And I think, you know, like I said, I can remember even, you know, I came to work here in January of 99, and I know driving out towards Ratcliffe, there would be one of those signs. And I remember sometime 99, 2000, some of the words were painted over. It was still the basic sign, but maybe it was selective, or I can't remember exactly. And there was this transition phase, because then ultimately this billboard just was all black. And I don't know, several months back, the post of it were still there. I guess my question is, and it's in light of, you know, I one time remember the signs, you know, we've got publications all through the 70s. I think it was an effort. The company was relatively new as far as being public company, so it was part of it, you know, as you said, a public educational program. You know, you can see Campbell now, they've bought the forest, so they put their billboards up. You know, it's, hey, this is who owns the forest. Campbell's proud, hopefully they're not proud of the clear cuts, but, you know, they said, you know, what is their little slogan, our job, you know, we're building homes every day, and they show pictures of deer and ducks and right. all that. But I guess I'm just, my question is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't remember seeing any kind of signs, hey, this is a, we're proud of this forest, this is a Temple forest, and I'm not saying that it wasn't, but do you remember anything about that, doing away with the billboards, or maybe that was before you came?
No, I mean, if you were seeing those in 99 or so, I don't remember us ever making a conscious decision to take them down or to ignore them.
I remember asking Carolyn Elmore about it.
Yeah, I was going to say Carolyn then, probably.
And anyway, I can't remember exactly what she said. And like I said, that's just something minor. But
well, I think Jonathan, and I'm shooting from the lip a little bit here, is that because of this pressure, because of you kind of went to say, okay, I don't need to advertise that we own this land if we're going to manage it in some way, right? So it became less of a. It became almost better, I guess, to be quiet and, you know, not advertise everything that you own, because it made you more of a target. That's about the only thing I can.
Because I remember, you know, I would just look for the blue spray paint to know, you know, where we're coming for us. And comment on this, because you had told me this one time, it's an interesting way to look at it, about specifically the sediment management zones and, you know, the clear cuts on Farm Market Road 1818 here, which, mm-hmm. you know, Alan Miller and others said that was Arthur Temple's driveway. You know, that road was put in so Arthur could have an easier way to get the pine land back. And, you know, and hey, don't ever cut this. You know, everybody wants to see the big mature trees. Yes, it only hides what's going on behind them, but, you know, nobody. Comment on the expectations of a new owner coming in and being expected to manage it the same way. And
yeah. Well, remember the example I gave you about the three answers to the question? Okay. You know, we knew there was fiber, and we knew exactly how much fiber. I mean, our models on our forest were better models than Campbell had, and we knew that because we had traded data with them and stuff. So we knew that. In fact, we did some of it over around Pineland. We went in some of those zones, and the way I described it to the foresters, I said, look, you can go in there and get some of that fiber. We need to get it, okay? We need to get it because it's over mature, or it's getting over mature. But just know it's going to cost you more to get it. You're going to have to leave. You can't go in there and set up a production operation and whack it down and, you know, and leave. So we cleaned up the tops. We got some fiber out and all that. So that was our approach to doing it. When Campbell bought this forest, they paid $2.3 billion for it. Okay.
Average of over a little over 2,000 an acre.
No, it was $1,623 an acre, or something like that.
But you had it on the books. Some of that was probably $10 an acre.
Some of it was 50 cents an acre. Yeah. But when you loaded it all in, it was about $200 an acre. And that was with, you know, the adding the O&I deal, putting it in, adding the $90 million for the cabin house.
All of
that.
It, right.
All that. So they buy this forest. And we had taken out in the sale, we took out what we considered high-value land. We took out minerals. We held out some of the water rights, which, you know, may or may not be worth anything to them. We kept out Boggy Slough and Scrapping Valley and areas around mills. And Four Star got to pick some stuff they thought had higher value one day.
Didn't Four Star get the mineral rights? All of it, or
Four Star has the mineral rights. That's all that's keeping them alive today.
Okay.
So here they are. They buy this, and in 2007, and lumber markets do this. Demand falls off, prices drop. We shut down the Buna sawmill, and they're sitting here having to get a return for the people that invested into this mill, and that fiber was there. And economics said you go cut it.
And we're talking about the big mature trees on the side of the highway.
Yeah, the appearance zones.
Yeah.
Okay.
They had to cut it because they had more. It cost them more money.
They needed the income. And it's easy to log right on the road. And there were periods where probably they couldn't get to some of the stuff they wanted to cut. And theoretically, they could do. The plantations behind it were tall enough. I've forgotten a lot of the sustainable forestry principles and stuff, but, you know, if you leave that appearance zone and plant a plantation behind it, the trees have to be, I think, 5 or 6 feet high before you're under the principles allowed to cut this. And you're allowed to do what they've done. So every place they had trees behind it, they cut them. And they'll grow back. You know, they'll plant them and they'll grow back. But it's just that different philosophy and different needs, and they don't have shareholders, but they have investors. And they're fighting for their lives on this stuff. They're fighting to make a return. Here's the interesting thing, Jonathan, and we're getting way off in this stuff. But CalPERS, the Public Employees Pension Fund of California, put $1 billion into this acquisition, okay? And if for some reason, and even though the returns are much lower, I'm sure, than they told CalPERS they would be, they're probably better than some of the other investments that CalPERS has. But CalPERS could call them tomorrow, unless it's in the contract some way. But theoretically, at some point, CalPERS is going to be able to call them and say, we'd like our money back, sell it. This forest will be sold again. Campbell will not manage this forest perpetually. Okay? It will either at about a 15-year period from what is around 2022 to 2025, more than likely, they're going to say it's time to sell it. If they can find somebody to buy it, and if they can get the prices they need, it'll be for sale again. That's the way the TMOs work.
What have you said, and I'm assuming he's talked to you about it. I don't know. I know I've heard, I'm talking about Joe Denman. People like Joe Denman who say, why did you sell the forest? Are you telling the same
stuff you're telling me? He knows. I didn't do it.
Okay.
Okay? He knows who did it.
Yeah.
I mean, Kenny did it.
Yeah.
Jastrow did it. So, no, I don't think any of the local people, you know, get any blame for this. And they know how things worked. And now I think Buddy feels a lot more pressure about that. Buddy told me it hurt him worse personally when we sold the forest than when we lost the company recently. And I believe that's true. I think that's true.
You know, he was even commenting on it. You remember the day we had the Arthur Temple statue dedication? I introduced him as Joe Temple. Remember that? But, you know, he even commented it on that publicly when he had the microphone out there.
Yeah.
And again, I guess that's you know, that's that older generation, that older management philosophy.
Well, they would have never thought about it. They would have never thought about it. So, there, I guess in Chapter 3 of this, we can talk about the end and kind of my perception of how we got to the end of Temple and why those decisions were made and to some degree how. Now, I don't know all the hows because there were special board meetings that I wasn't involved in, a couple of those and stuff, but I do know a lot of stuff around it. And
I'd like to talk, too, a little bit about the, you mentioned it briefly, Sustainable Forestry
Initiative
and the ISO 14001 or whatever, you know, but, you know, the company spent a good bit of time and expenses in being certified, if that's the right word, but, you know, to participate in those programs. I just wanted to ask you about, you know, what was the motivation there, what was involved and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was part of that growing environmental pressure and, you know, that the forest products companies were cutting stuff too fast and that there wouldn't be perpetual forests and it was all going to go away and it was all about money and stuff. And we got caught up in that. I mean, you know, even though we were always given extra credit for the way we managed the forest, we didn't get a free pass. You know, there were Temple was under pressure and our employees felt bad about, you know, what they heard about what was going on in other places, and they'd say, we're not doing that. Why are we getting painted with that brush? But we were. And you know, the Sustainable Forest Initiative was an industry driven set of standards which didn't achieve a lot of acceptance by the environmental community. It was like the fox guarding the hen house type deal. So there were other approaches that people favored more, you know, some of the environmental groups favored more. And they're still out there, and there's still kind of some debate going on. But what's happened to some degree, Jonathan, now that this timberland has changed hands out of the Forest Products Company's hands, I think most environmental groups will tell you that the forest products companies, the large forest products companies, were doing a better job managing the forest than they were getting credit for. They were just an easy target, you know?
Well, that was the question I think a lot of people had was, you know, how can somebody from outside, even outside the region, state, whatever, manage it any better than somebody who's been doing it for over a century? You know?
Well, they can't. Yeah, I mean, the answer, they can't. They won't. They will replant it. They probably won't invest as much in replanting as the forest products companies were doing because, you know, everybody had gotten to things like, you know, competition control. We were planting a growing number of seedlings that were containerized, that would grow faster, that had better survival rates and stuff like that. And, you know, to plant a regular seedling may cost you a nickel to grow it and get it ready to plant. And these containerized seedlings cost you a dollar. So, you know, who are they going to spend a dollar to do it? I can assure you they're not. But they'll put a seedling in the ground and they'll want good survival because they have to have a forest to sell, right? They have to have a forest to sell. And they have to be able to model it and show the growth is going to be there, survival rates are going to be there, and that they're doing a good job managing it. If they don't do that, then they're, you know, they're not meeting their commitments to their investors. Because the investors, look, and I'll say this and we can stop. The analysis of what people could pay for a forest that they bought from Temple was a straightforward net present value calculation using a assumed discount rate. So they would come to you and say, given these assumptions, you as an investor, these assumptions, and this is how we're going to manage this. These are our assumptions on timber prices, land prices, growth, all those things. We're going to give you a 6% real return on your investment. But a big part of that, Jonathan, in a net present value calculation is the terminal value of the asset. And that means you sell it at the end, and those cash flows come back. Those cash flows are discounted back to present values, net present value, and that terminal value is a huge driver of that return. So it's a financial analysis overlaid to something that's growing, right? And here's what I always told our guys. We can put up all the signs in the world, okay? We can publicize things. We're going to be judged by what we do on the ground, okay? How we leave a site when we've harvested, how many tops we leave, how do we replant, what kind of survival rates, how soon we replant, what areas don't we cut, you know, how many trees do you leave on a streamside management zone? Because you can go in there and meet the standards and it looks like a little ribbon of trees. Or you can go in there and leave enough trees that really is a pathway for animals and, you know, you're going to protect that stream and the water quality and stuff like that. But when you get down to the finances of that and you're in there harvesting that, financially you'll say, get as much as you can get, right? And if you're a forester who has procurement responsibilities, and the paper mill is low on wood, and your job, there's a great old story, and this is the last story I'm going to tell today, about the paper mill almost, Evadale. This was before it was part of Temple. It was about to run out of wood. And the general manager comes down to meet with the manufacturing guys and the forest guys. Okay? And he's telling them they got to get wood. They were cutting fence rows and different, you know, things like that. And a little forester in the back of the room raises his hand. He says, you got any questions? Raises his hand. And general manager says, yeah, what's your question? He says, sir, have we ever thought about slowing down the paper machines? And the answer was, and it had happened 20 years before, and I still heard about it when I was running forest. The answer was, we might consider slowing down the paper machines, but if we do, you won't be here to count the revolutions, young man. Okay? In other words, your job is go get fiber. And that's why the answer to those questions were different. And that's why we separated in our organization. We had people who, they got fiber. And that was their job, to get fiber. But the foresters over here, these guys, their job was to grow this forest and to meet those environmental standards. That was what they did every day. They didn't worry about if there was wood under the crane at the dye ball sawmill.
Okay? Okay. All right, well, thank you. We'll end round two. Ding, ding.
Ding, ding. Thanks, John.
Thank you.
And I think you had a really good idea.